This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, coming home, face masks, health checks and a long flight. Australians caught in Wuhan begin the journey back, many wrangling small children.
They have been asking me how long this is going to take every second. And they describe this as the most horrifying airport experience ever. Which is true.
And a cabinet reshuffle and a tussle for the Nationals' deputy leadership sparked by Bridget McKenzie's resignation over the sports grant scandal. More than 100 Australians in the viral epicentre Wuhan are boarding an evacuation flight that will take them to Christmas Island via Western Australia. The Qantas 747 is the first of two flights that will take several hundred Australian citizens and permanent residents out of the lockdown city. Some have declined evacuation, choosing to wait things out, but others have put their concerns aside as the crisis deepens. Here's our China correspondent, Bill Birtles.
Many who were boarding the flight this morning had to overcome fears about the indirect route home. Among them, a mother of three from Sydney, Gloria Zung, who only decided to go at the last minute.
I got a lot of pressure from my husband. And he said, oh, the situation's not really good. All the other countries start to close the borders. He said, if we stay over here, probably it would have taken a couple of months to get out from Wuhan. So he started to become really nervous.
She says getting to the airport was smooth, with Australian officials helping organise passes to get through roadblocks in Wuhan. But getting three small children to wear their masks in the middle of an epidemic wasn't easy.
But looks like now the kids are exposed to germs everywhere. I'm really nervous. They're running around, they're touching the ground, touching everything, and then they put fingers into mouth. So it's out of control.
It will be a long journey. The Qantas 747 will first fly to Exmouth in Western Australia, where the evacuees will transfer at RAAF base Learmonth to smaller charter flights for a four-hour flight to the island. They'll then spend 2 weeks at the almost empty immigration detention centre with a team of doctors and nurses before being flown to Perth, assuming they show no signs of the novel coronavirus. Moko Young, an Australian citizen in Wuhan who's planning to take the second evacuation flight in the coming days, says staying in the lockdown city isn't much of an option.
If you stay here, say you need to buy food, you're only able to ride a share bike to the supermarket. Everyone's staying indoors. The streets are quiet. There are parts of the city with a high number of infection cases that are blocked off too.
Finding an alternative way home also looks increasingly difficult. Australia joined the US and Singapore over the weekend in barring Chinese citizens from entering the country, along with any traveller who's recently been to China. Australian citizens or those with Australian spouses or families can still fly home, but Qantas will soon join a growing list of international airlines to suspend flights in and out of China. This extraordinary upheaval has affected everyone across the world's most populous nation. And with more cases and a rising death toll each day, authorities here are desperately hoping they're nearing the turning point for this outbreak. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
The Qantas Chief Executive Alan Joyce says plenty of safety precautions have been taken for this evacuation flight.
All the passengers and the crew have been given masks and hand sanitizers, and crew have gloves. The aircraft have these medical-grade filters on them, which actually eliminate 99% of particles, including viruses. It's a lot safer than, a lot cleaner than being in a restaurant, in an office.
That's the Qantas boss, Alan Joyce. He was speaking there on RM Breakfast. AM has been following the plight of one family caught up in the coronavirus crisis. Lily is a Sydney mum who's been visiting her mother in Wuhan with her two children aged 4 and 5. Reporter Barbara Miller caught up with her this morning during a long and tiring wait to board the Qantas flight to Australia.
We've been here for around 6 hours. We've been here since 6. It's now 1 o'clock, so 7 hours. It's complete chaos. We only been given a number and no seat being allocated, and then we'll have to basically manually drag all our luggage to get it checked as well. And now we're waiting to get into security, and the line is about 100, 150 meters long, and we're waiting for the last 50 meters, and it has moved about 5 meters in the past hour.
And so have you had any health checks up till now?
We had a little check when we drove up to the airport, but we're going to have more thorough exam. I guess that's why it's so slow. There are three flights, flight to fly out from Wuhan tonight. I'm not sure where the other two are going. We're kind of standing in the mixed crowd and everyone just being less and less patient.
How are the kids holding up?
They are being little champions. They're still awake, which is surprising and very helpful. They have been asking me how long this is going to take every second. And they describe this as the most horrifying airport experience ever, which is true.
Are the people who are dealing with you just wearing masks, or are they wearing more protective gear?
They are what we call the little yellow man. They're all in full yellow suits with masks and glasses. It's mainly the Chinese airport staff, the Qantas staff and the Australian embassy staff. They're just with masks and some with glasses. Some do have some sort of protection over their body.
And how are you feeling about the prospect of the journey ahead to, we understand, mainland Australia and then up to Christmas Island?
The way of going home just seems so far and confused, and we still don't know any condition-wise information about where we're going, and it's quite frustrating. Oh, love, are you okay?
You okay?
Yes, she's okay. She's very tired.
Is there any sign anyone's going to help you with the kids?
I'm pretty much on my own, all by myself, hoping for the best.
That's Lily, a Sydney mother, speaking there with Barbara Miller from Wuhan Airport. Australia's tourism operators say the government's decision to ban travellers coming via China couldn't have come at a worse time, with visitor numbers already plummeting after the bushfires. David Sparks reports.
With views of the Sydney Harbour Bridge and Opera House, Sydney's Circular Quay is usually packed with tourists. But Scott McDermott, who's lead skipper for Thunderjet Boat Rides, says right now it's quiet.
Today it is particularly quiet, and we have had 2 cancellations this morning because people have feared bringing their kids into the city with the coronavirus. To be honest, we have had that happen. We had a good season, but it was still a little bit quiet. I believe it was affected due to the bushfires.
And now the tough new restrictions on arrivals from China have added to fears about the future, held by business operators like Henry Chung, who's run a souvenir shop in front of the ferry terminal for 30 years.
It's very bad, at least 50% down, I think. This summer is one of the worst summer we ever had.
What do you think is the main reason?
Bushfire and coronavirus.
Nearby, Omid Naya runs a shop selling indigenous crafts.
We came off a bumper November, December and January until the last week of it due to many factors, not just the coronavirus, but the bushfires, the bad press we got. But I must say the last week or so, it's been very quiet. And I would say that, yes, the coronavirus epidemic and the bushfires have really affected the trade for tourists coming to Australia.
In the historic Rocks District, Emily Doan is selling handmade jewellery at a market stall. Opening hours had been extended to cater for the expected Lunar New Year business boom, but it didn't come.
In the previous years, it's been packed, so usually that's why we used to have 2 people on team at all times, but this year it's been a lot slower.
Margie Osmond from the Tourism and Transport Forum backs the government's new border controls, but she knows they'll come at a cost.
China now represents about 1.4 million inbound visitors into Australia every year. They're an extremely large component of the $46 billion or thereabouts that comes into our economy from inbound internationals. They represent about $12 billion, and they are the biggest spenders.
And these business operators know a ban on people travelling from China will have a big impact.
I think it's going to have detrimental effects on these businesses, and it's going to be quite devastating for a lot of businesses.
Inbound Chinese tourism is a big part of our market here in Sydney, and without them around, especially this time of year with Chinese New Year cranking, yeah, I mean, look at all the sculptures around us. There's not a lot of Chinese people walking around, and yeah, that does affect us.
That's jet boat skipper Scott McDermott, and ending that report by David Sparks. A short time ago, I spoke with the Trade and Tourism Minister. Simon Birmingham, welcome to AM.
Good morning, Sabra.
Do you have an estimate of how many Chinese tourists have been turned around or have cancelled their trips as a result of the new travel ban?
I don't have a precise estimate there, Sabra, but the impact of this is great and significant for Australia's tourism industry, for our international education sector, also for Australian exporters as well, who will find it increasingly challenging in some instances to either access the China market or already facing the downturn in terms of demand in China as a result of slowing in their economy and consumption.
Your tourism minister, how many tourists were you expecting from China in the next fortnight?
Look, China is our largest international market. We expect in terms of Chinese tourists over the course of the year that they generate around $11 billion worth of spend across Australia. That's spread relatively evenly through the course of the year. Now, that is concentrated more in some of the significant eastern city markets. So we can sort of isolate to some extent where it will have an impact. But we know as well that in certain regional areas like the Gold Coast, North Queensland as well, they have significant proportions of
Chinese tourists. You'd have a ballpark figure though, surely.
Look, in terms of the fortnight, Sabra, I can't put a precise figure there on it. We are obviously talking, though, thousands of tourists and travellers.
What's the economic impact of this when you look at the cancelled trips plus Chinese university students being forced to delay a return, you know, putting off the first semester? $13 billion is the figure that's been floated around this morning. Is that about right?
Look, it's, as I said, you know, we estimate in terms of tourism contribution around $11 billion or so. But this is, you know, this is our largest tourism market, our largest international education market, our largest trading partner. So, of course, it is a significant and severe impact.
Should Australia be prepared for a recession from all of this?
Look, I'll let the economic analysts make their predictions in that regard. We as a government are not underestimating the gravity and the severity of the decision that had to be taken. Of course, Australians expect public health comes first, and we have followed and acted every step of the way on the advice of our public health officials. In terms of our tourism industry, we already had a record budget for Tourism Australia. We added and injected a further $76 million as part of our bushfire response, and we will now work very carefully to see how we can recalibrate our investment in our tourism industry to help them through this tough time.
All right. This will be a triple whammy for some businesses that have been affected by the bushfires, downturn in domestic tourism, now this. You just touched on the fact that there was a package for tourism operators in January. Are you considering additional financial help for these people?
I'll sit down today and talk to the tourism industry. We had consultations over the weekend. I had directly with a number of industry figures. The Tourism Australia Board convened for an extraordinary meeting on Saturday night, which I addressed. And we will continue to, as I say, firstly, look at how we can recalibrate within existing resources our campaigns, and particularly the domestic campaign, which we have not launched from Tourism Australia in recent years, a domestic campaign urging Australians to holiday here this year. And I really would encourage everybody, if you're planning a break at some point this year, you may well be saving the jobs and the small businesses of fellow Australians by doing so, and you'll have a fantastic time. And so please heed that campaign.
To Bridget McKenzie's departure, on a technicality and not on how she awarded the taxpayer dollars to community groups, how comfortable are you with that?
Sabra, I think Bridget, indeed, having resigned, has taken responsibility for the failure that was identified in the report undertaken by the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. The government's also made clear that we're going to act on the Auditor General's key recommendations in relation to how such schemes are operated in the future, and that's what we'll get on and do.
Your colleague Darren Chester said last week that one of the biggest problems in politics right now is the trust deficit between politicians and the people you represent. Surely this isn't helping close that gap.
These types of issues never help, Sabra. I think, though, you've been around politics a long time. You know that these types of issues come up from time to time. What's important is how government responds to them, and we're going to respond with the minister having resigned and with the government getting on and implementing the key recommendations from the Auditor General.
It was on a technicality. There are many voters who are disillusioned with politics right now. How do you think that they will regard the Auditor General's finding on this program, that decisions were not informed by appropriate assessment processes and sound advice, that political considerations trumped that.
Sabra, we're going to get on and implement and act on the Auditor General's recommendation. That is what we do to address these issues in terms of for the future and making sure that ministers who do need to have and do need to have an opportunity to be able to make decisions in relation to grants. I know that when I was Education Minister, I had to overrule decisions, for example, in relation to the Healthy Harold program that I know many New South Wales listeners in particular, as a school education program, had been defunded at an official level and required my decision as Minister to overrule that determination. So you do have to step in at certain times, but we clearly take the Auditor General's findings seriously and we're going to act on them.
Minister, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thank you, Sabra.
And that's the Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham. Escalating fears about the spread of the virus will be at the top of the agenda at the Reserve Bank Board's first meeting of the year tomorrow. The cash rate looks set to remain on hold as the RBA gauges the coronavirus fallout, along with the bushfire crisis and the continuing drought. Our senior business correspondent is Peter Ryan. Good morning, Pete. Look, late last year, the expectations were that the board would cut rates again as early as February, but a lot's happened since then.
Well, good morning, Sabra. Last year, it was the US-China trade war, Brexit and US tensions with Iran. Those headwinds are now very much in the background. The new focus is the bushfires crisis in southeast Australia. And the big one, of course, is coronavirus. The RBA board, like all other central banks around the world, will have coronavirus at the top of its agenda tomorrow. But most economists think the RBA will be in wait-and-see mode. What's known as the RBA's shadow board at the Australian National University agrees the RBA will keep its rates powder dry for now. But the shadow board's chairman, Dr. Tim O'Henkel, says the coronavirus is a potential shock that could hit the economy hard and jeopardise the federal government's projected budget surplus.
Clearly, everyone is trying to figure out just how impactful this coronavirus outbreak will be. But now that flights from China to Australia have been stopped, trade flows will be impacted, but also the flow of people in and out of the countries. That's going to prove to be quite disruptive.
So in addition to the bushfires crisis and the drought, coronavirus is now an immediate new concern of global proportion. So how serious is the economic risk to Australia?
It has a potential, given our interconnectedness, to be important. Perhaps not so much the importance for tomorrow, but if the outbreak is still something that we're trying to get on top of in a month's time, then I think it will probably also affect monetary policy more significantly.
ANZ economists are already predicting that the coronavirus could take $450 million a month out of the economy just based on tourism, and that is looking at the SARS benchmark. Could that just be the start and perhaps enough to push a negative quarter of GDP?
There's always the possibility that one only moderately sized negative shock actually triggers a downward spiral.
So could coronavirus be that shock?
That's a possibility, sure.
Do you see that the projected budget surplus could be at risk because of these combined factors?
Absolutely. And if that means that the budget surplus is not nearly as large as originally projected by the government, or it even goes somewhat into deficit, shouldn't be a problem.
That's Dr. Tim O'Henkel, the chair of the RBA Shadow Board at the Australian National University, speaking there with Peter Ryan. And Peter, China's share market reopens later today after the Lunar New Year holidays were extended because of the coronavirus fears. What are you expecting?
Well, Sabra, China's key share markets in Shanghai and Shenzhen have been closed for the past week as Chinese authorities move to stop panic selling given the coronavirus hit to the economy and steep falls are expected this morning. At the same time, China's central bank has stepped in with a raft of emergency stimulus measures to deal with the coronavirus impact, given the damage to business and consumer confidence. And the People's Bank of China will today inject 1.2 trillion yuan or RMB, that's around 260 billion Australian dollars, into the economy to maintain liquidity in the banking system, referring to, quote, a period of epidemic prevention and control.
That's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Gone but not forgotten. Bridget McKenzie is on the government backbench, but the scandal that brought her undone is threatening to roll on. But first, the Nationals must choose a new deputy leader to replace her, with the winner to take her place in cabinet. And already, that's looking pretty complicated. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
Sources tell AM there'll be around half a dozen candidates to replace Bridget McKenzie when the party room meeting, scheduled for tomorrow, convenes to choose a new deputy leader. Water Minister David Littleproud, Veterans Affairs Minister Darren Chester and former leader Barnaby Joyce are all expected to run.
It's up to others if there's a spill. I believe that I've done the job before. Every seat we've got is one I won in the previous election before the one we've just had. But I'll leave that up to my colleagues. They can make the call.
Junior Minister Keith Pitt tells AM he'll also have a go. It's all but certain the Nationals will choose a man to take Senator McKenzie's place in Cabinet.
I'm very sad that Bridget's going. I thought that she did a really good job.
That's Michelle Landry, the party's whip, who says Bridget McKenzie will be remembered for her energy.
There was only Bridget and I there for quite a while, so there's six of us there now. So, you know, I'm sure there'll be opportunities for other members, female members of the Nationals, to get into positions.
Will you yourself be now contesting the deputy leadership?
No, I will not be.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced Senator McKenzie's resignation alone. Nationals leader and Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack issued a statement only, thanking her for her service.
Where is Mr McCormack?
On his way to Canberra.
Who will now be serving as Agriculture Minister?
Oh, the Deputy Prime Minister will be appointed as Acting Agriculture Minister.
I couldn't tell you where Michael was. He may have had other duties that he was attending to, so I couldn't comment on that, really.
Would you have expected him to be there, given it was his deputy leader who was resigning?
Look, Michael's given Bridget a lot of support. So, as I said, he may have had other, commitments that had kept him away. I mean, he's a busy man.
Senator McKenzie's undoing was her failure to declare her membership in one gun club and close association with another. Both got funding under the controversial sports grants program she administered. Scott Morrison's top bureaucrat, Phil Gaitchens, found that breached ministerial standards, but he cleared her of the accusation that started the whole affair.
He did not find evidence that this process was unduly influenced by reference to marginal or targeted electorates.
That's contrary to the findings of an Auditor-General report in January that suggested the minister overruled her bureaucrats and favoured such seats with funding from the program. Labor frontbencher Matt Keogh says projects in his electorate were overlooked.
One of my local governments was one of the top-rated programs to get funding under this program, as revealed by the ABC, and they didn't get anything. So if the Prime Minister can come and justify that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, he's justifying with the head of his department finding that, which is different to what, obviously, the Auditor-General said. Who should people believe him?
Well, I noticed that the Auditor-General's report is public and the Prime Minister's keeping his departmental secretary's report, who used to be his Chief of Staff's report, private, and I think the public can draw their own conclusions from that.
Labor's vowing to press ahead with the Senate inquiry into the affair, and it has the numbers, at least for now, on the Senate crossbench to make that happen.
Tom Eagledon reporting there. Police in the UK have shot dead a man in South London following a stabbing attack that officials are describing as a terrorist-related incident. Our correspondent Linton Besser is in the Streatham neighbourhood.
At about 2 o'clock this afternoon, Sabra, specialist armed police were called here to where I'm standing on Streatham High Street. It's a bustling main road in southwest London. And that's when witnesses and bystanders reported hearing the ring of 3 or 4 gunshots. There are reports emerging that this attacker, Sabra, entered a shop a few blocks south of where I'm standing with a knife and started to stab random people. He then left the shop, and there are reports he stabbed another person before he was shot dead by police. And this is what some bystanders had to say earlier.
I don't know how to describe it. It's like a movie. It was so quick, and it was like a panic.
And then our friends who also live above us said they heard some shots. I think they said about 3 or 4 went off.
Heard that there was a shooting, that somebody was stabbing people and they have to shoot him.
And then I heard like a shout, and then everyone ran off. And one guy laying on the floor and definite blood around him.
Police were very quickly on the scene here, including plain-clothed police. And the Metropolitan Police were very quick to declare that this was a terrorist incident. They've also confirmed that 3 people are believed to have been injured and are being treated in hospital. Sabra, one of those people is in a life-threatening condition and police have said that they've informed their next of kin. So a very serious incident with echoes of, you know, the last terrorist attack in London, which was very similar, an apparent lone wolf attack near London Bridge with a knife-wielding attacker.
Linton, though, this incident was a bit of a departure from attacks in recent years in the British capital that took place near high-profile landmarks.
Well, that's what's quite frightening about this. Streatham, it is a busy part of London, but you'd have to call it a kind of inner city suburb. It is nowhere near any of the classic landmarks that people gather at. It's not London Bridge. It's not Borough Markets. It's certainly not the Palace of Westminster. I live a couple of suburbs north of here, and it just looks like any kind of high street through the middle of London. So that certainly is different. And there are also questions, Sabra, about just how quickly police responded. There are videos online of a row of plainclothes police approaching the man with guns drawn. To have gotten there so quickly and for the incident to have been declared a terrorist incident so quickly is raising questions about whether this man was already under active surveillance by police or by MI5.
And that's our Europe correspondent, Linton Besser, in South London. Democratic candidates vying to be their party's presidential nominee are making their final pitches to registered voters in the Midwestern state of Iowa. But for the first time, several of the frontrunners have lost valuable time on the ground because they've been stuck at President Donald Trump's impeachment trial. Our North America correspondent, Catherine Diss, is in Iowa.
On Monday, we get to go and send a message to the nation that we want Bernie Sanders to be the next president of the United States.
From bands to filmmakers, Bernie Sanders knows how to draw a crowd. For the time they are stuck in Washington, D.C. for the president's impeachment trial, the senator started the final sprint to the vote with some big names in showbiz. Among them, Grammy Award-winning band Bon Iver.
Let's go get this one for Bernie now.
Despite the unwanted distraction, he's not losing support.
While it's cool to see Bernie, I think we're all here for the ideas and values that he stands for rather than...
The 78-year-old progressive from Vermont is leading in the polls, garnering a huge following of young voters.
Where have you come from?
Peoria, Illinois. It's about 5 hours east of Des Moines.
That's quite a significant drive, but you're quite passionate about Bernie?
Yes, absolutely. We all are.
19-year-old college student Mark Tangell backs Bernie's ambitious climate change plan and his socialist policies. But if he doesn't get the nomination...
Come November, and I guess we're ahead of ourselves, but I will be voting blue regardless. People's lives depend on this election, quite literally. So that
the other frontrunner is also in his late 70s and white, former Vice President Joe Biden.
They don't want me to be the nominee because they know I'll beat him like a drum.
Who would you put your money on at this stage?
Biden, because everybody's making the electability argument. He's the moderate. Him and Bernie, I think, are currently leading the polls, but my money would be on Biden.
2 hours' drive from the state capital, Des Moines, Bernie's progressive rival, Elizabeth Warren, canvassed the east of the state. She too started the weekend before the caucus on the back foot.
I've been in Washington for a long time, locked down, and I need to get to a lot of places.
Flying in overnight, her message was simple.
We will, we must come together as a party and beat Donald Trump.
While the issues do matter, the overwhelming goal, electing a nominee who can beat Donald Trump. Dennis Goldford has written a book about the Iowa caucuses and why it matters.
They are a barometer, a weather vane.
But is he willing to take a punt on who will win?
I don't make predictions. I still think at this point it would be very foolish.
While the winner isn't yet clear, if history's anything to go by, whoever takes the cake in Iowa is likely to seize the nomination. It's happened 7 of the past 9 times. This is Catherine Diss in Iowa, reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lay.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
2 weeks and two reports later, Bridget McKenzie has quit the front bench over the whole sports rot scandal. But the government's still defending the way it ran the program.
So is this the end of the story? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.